Okay, welcome everybody. This is the office hours session for week three of the Mises Academy online class, Introduction to the Free Market. It's actually only the second office hours session associated with this course, though, because last week I was traveling and just couldn't fit in a Saturday session because I was at this conference all day. Okay, so as is our want, I'll just throw it open to you guys who are tuned in live here. Just go ahead and start the ball rolling. Remember, no question, no matter how silly you think it may be or trivial, can possibly be worse than just sitting here looking at my video. All right, let's see. Okay, Kim Alexander says, can you tell us about your debate last weekend? Sure. So it was against Bill Still, I almost called him Bill Master, who is the creator of there's a famous documentary within, I guess you call them, conspiracy circles called The Money Masters. And he's also done some work. The guy Bill Still is associated with that. He created it. And it does a good job. I have not watched the whole thing. I think I came across it because I watched some other sort of conspiracy video a few years ago that was highly recommended for being pretty good in that genre. And I think it probably, and there's other video that I did watch kind of grab pieces here and there from other such productions. And so I think it drew on the footage from Money Master. So I've seen parts of it, but not, like I say, the source material, looking at that thing from start to finish. But anyway, so Bill Still, if you're interested in the debate, by the way, it's, you know, just go to YouTube and type in Robert Murphy, Bill Still debate. If that's not helping you, it was at the Save Long Island event. And so if you have those three words in there too, that surely would let you home in on it. So the debate was supposed to be over, I guess you call it, monetary policy. And the deal is that Bill and I, of course, both agree that having a Federal Reserve is a crazy idea and that it's the source of a lot of our economic instability, and that there's, beyond it just being a bad idea and in a scholarly abstract sense, that it's also an engine of corruption and that it allows shady characters behind the scenes to bilk the public and enrich themselves. So we're in agreement on all that. The main disagreement, and unfortunately this didn't really come out in the debate, because in the debate, and I think I haven't had a chance to look at to go to the film and watch it again, but somebody along the way, it might have even been the moderator, I can't remember, or it could have been someone in the Q&A, but somehow early on in the debate we got sidetracked into the fact that I am an anarcho-capitalist in the Rothbardian tradition and that Bill Still is not. Bill Still calls himself a constitutionalist, meaning he believes in the kind of scope of government as envisioned by the Founding Fathers, and that he thinks America should go back to that, and then we'd be fine. You know, that's the ideal form of government, whereas, of course, that's not my ideal. So it was a bit unfortunate because, even though that's a great debate to have, Bill Still is not really the best person to be debating that particular topic. You know, what he's known for, what he's famous for, is his work on the Money Masters and exposing the corruption of central banks and their influence on politics and so forth. So what I wish we had focused on is, and let me put it to you this way, so as our solutions were so radically different, that we both, in the terms of what's going on with money in the current world, we both largely agree in our critique of the system, of how it's rigged in favor of international bankers, and it's totally designed to screw over the little guy, and beyond that, that these bankers actually control the political process, that it's actually naive to get mad at Barack Obama or to get mad at George W. Bush and think that that's where the buck stops, is with the person who's in the White House. But that's actually pretty naive, that, no, those people are actually just put forth by their respective political parties, and the parties in turn are controlled by these groups who have no national allegiance and so on. So it's kind of, you know, it sounds really crazy, nut job, black helicopter conspiracy theory stuff if you've never delved into that. But that was part of the point of this conference, was to say, look, if this is not crazy stuff, that really what's crazy is to think that Barack Obama is the one making all the decisions that affect the United States and the world, and that he can do whatever he wants, and that there's no influence on him, even though obviously somebody had to fund his campaign, he had to be embraced by the Democratic Party, and blah, blah, blah. You know, the major media organizations had to go along with pushing him into that position. So I think what's really crazy and naive is the version of how the world works was taught to us if you went to any kind of typical school, if you're in the United States. So, but anyway, the main difference between Bill Still and me when it comes to money and banking is that his solution is to say, look, this is crazy. Instead of having the federal government run deficits and then issue bonds that are then purchased by the Fed, and now the taxpayers have to pay interest to these private bankers who own the Fed because they lent us money that they created out of thin air. And so now the taxpayers are paying hundreds of billions of dollars a year in interest to these bankers for the privilege of borrowing money that we gave them the legal ability to create out of nothing. You know, so if you put it like that, that is kind of crazy. That's an insane system. But still, the solution is to say, give the printing press back to the Treasury. And let's just cut out the middleman. Instead of, so if we're going to create new money ultimately to fund government spending, then don't have the government borrow on it and let private interest issue that money. Instead, take that power and put it back in the hands of the government. And Still thinks that there's constitutional authority for that, because there is a clause in the Constitution saying that Congress shall have the right to issue and coin money, or, you know, something like that. I don't know the exact word, as though he thinks. So the federal government has the right to issue dollars, and let's just cut out the middleman. Instead of creating this quasi-private organization called the Federal Reserve and giving them the ability to create new base money, just have the Treasury do it directly. So we're not paying interest on it. Yeah, that'll still cause prices to rise. And so it's not that it's a magic genie bottle that gives us all kinds of goods and services for nothing or for free, but at least we're cutting out the middleman, and at least the public now will have much more oversight on what's going on with the creation of dollars than putting it in the hands of this shadowy organization that we can't even audit. Okay, so I'm putting words in his mouth, but I'm pretty sure that's a faithful summary of what his position is. And part of my problem with that debate is I have to put words in his mouth, because that stuff didn't come out during the debate. That I even asked somebody afterward. I said, hey, do you know that Bill Still is in favor of giving the printing press to the Treasury and letting them spend more than they take in tax revenue? Because throughout the debate, Bill just kept saying how, hey, I'm not going to, you know, we should make it so the federal government can't borrow money anymore. And everyone was clapping in favor of that. But my understanding of his position, that doesn't mean restrict the government's spending to what they take in tax revenues. I think what he means is the government can still spend more than it takes in tax receipts, but the difference would be funded by just simple inflation of creating new money rather than issuing bonds and then borrowing from outside lenders. So, of course, if you're at all familiar with my views or Murray Rothbard's views, what I would say, and this is what I told the crowd there, that, even though Bill and I agree on diagnosing the problem, generally speaking, our solutions are radically different, and I say take money in banking and put it back in the hands of the private sector, that just as you wouldn't want to have the government have monopoly production over cars or computers or stakes, why in the world do we vest the power of creating new money in the hands of the federal government? That's insane. And so that was my position. Okay, so those were the things, but like I say, the debate kind of got sidetracked into talking about anarchy versus minarchy. which is a perfectly fine debate to have, but it was not the one I wanted to have with Bill Stowe. Okay, Joe says, how come I do not hear much about the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, which is the central bank of the central banks? That's a great question, Joe, and I think the answer, well, there's two possibilities. One possibility is that they actually don't have that much power. Just like if you want to know about foreign policy and figure out what's going to happen, you know, like is the United States going to go to war with Iran? I think it's probably more important for you to follow developments in Washington, D.C. and the way that the American media is treating that issue and perhaps in Israel rather than asking what do UN officials think about it. Because if it comes to something like is the U.S. going to start dropping bombs on Iran, I think if the people in Washington want to do it and that the people in Israel think it's a good idea, then those are really the only checks I could see on the U.S. doing it. Whereas, you know, like if the U.N. doesn't sign off on it, it doesn't matter. It's my, you know, quick read of that kind of situation with foreign policy. So it's possible the same thing with international finance that the Bank for International Settlements is more of a clearinghouse and it's not like they exercise a lot of independent control over what happened. So if you really want to know what's the Fed going to do, what's the ECB going to do, you don't go ask high-level officials at the BIS, you go ask high-level officials at the Fed or at the ECB or you know, the Council of Foreign Relations, whatever groups you think are in control, it's conceivable that the BIS is not. So that's one hypothesis as to why you never hear them is because they're not really that important. The other hypothesis is the exact opposite, to say they're so important that they purposely want to stay behind the scenes. And just to give you an idea, the Federal Reserve was not talked about much 15 years ago. It was really the Ron Paul campaign that put the Fed on the map politically in the United States. And then, of course, after the 2008 crisis, then it was hard to avoid dealing with the Fed because the Fed had to step up and just grew its power so tremendously. There was no way they could do that, still remain shadowy behind the scenes. But a lot of, like I say, even just 15 years ago, people didn't talk about the Fed. The Fed was just kind of like this boring institutional background thing that nobody really cared about. You would learn about it in an econ class just to see how do open market operations work, but it wasn't like the Fed was this hot button political issue. So by the same, but of course it really was powerful, and cynics would argue they liked it that way, that nobody talked about it and they just took it for granted so it could go about its business without drawing attention to itself. So it's possible the BIS is an analogous position, that actually they do wield a tremendous amount of power, but they don't want the media covering it and so on. So I actually, to be honest with you, Joe, I don't know enough about it to even weigh in on which of those two possibilities is correct. So I'm just going to have to plead ignorance on that. But you're certainly right. Your observation is correct, or I agree with it, that you barely ever hear anybody covering the Bank for International Settlements, even though one might think that that's kind of a big deal. That it's just like the – so for people who don't know, just like the central banks are kind of like at the top of the pyramid when it comes to banking within a country. So in the United States, the Federal Reserve is like the banker's bank. So commercial banks, with whom do they bank? Who is their banker? It's obviously the Federal Reserve. And in Europe, it's the ECB. But what Joe is saying is, look, there's not – the Federal Reserve does not encompass every commercial bank on earth. It only encompasses the ones in the United States. And the ECB is just Europe. So how do you handle – interbank settlements and things like that, transactions that are going from dollars to euros and blah, 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 that it's the Bank for International Settlements that's based in Switzerland is actually the Fed's banker in that respect and the ECB's banker. So if you want to construct pyramids of banking hierarchy, the BIS would be on a level above even the Fed and the ECB. And yet, So in principle, you would think, wow, that's got to be a really powerful institution. And presumably investigative journalists are watching that thing like a hawk and parsing their statements. What is the BIS going to do next month? Or what do they think about this this trade negotiation between Asian countries? And you don't even know. People don't even have never even heard of the BIS. So you're certainly true, Joe, that nobody talks about it. And whether that is because it's truly innocuous and it's not worth covering, or because it's such a big deal that it shrouds itself in secrecy, I don't know enough about it to guess one way or the other. Okay, Andrew says, some people claim that the Federal Reserve... We're really getting into conspiracy stuff today. This is awesome. All right. So Andrew says, some people claim that the Federal Reserve is partially owned and run by the Rothschilds. What is your take on that? My guess is that it's probably true, but that it would be surprising if it weren't, and I just mean it in this respect, that there is a sense in which the Federal Reserve is a privately owned corporation. And this isn't a conspiracy theory. This is, you know, it's probably in Wikipedia. That the institutional structure of the Federal Reserve, the member banks own shares of stock in the Fed. And so that's whereas it's not like anybody owns shares of stock in the EPA or in the IRS or in the Department of Transportation. But commercial or banks do own shares of stock in the Federal Reserve. And so that's the sense. So for some activists in the liberty movement, that is like they think that is the number one thing you need to get the public to know, to realize that something is rotten in the state of Denmark when it comes to monetary policy. The Fed is privately owned. So from a Rothbardian perspective, so what? I mean, that's other things equal. If something's privately owned, that's a good thing. That's better than being owned by the government. To say, oh, I don't trust that grocery store because it's privately owned. Well, it doesn't make any sense, you know. Or, you know, hey, you want to go see a movie? Well, no, that theater is privately owned. You know, the owners of that theater really are just interested in making a profit. So why would you expect the movies they show to be any good? You see how that's a non sequitur? What are you talking about? Yeah, because they want to make a profit, they're going to make sure that the movie, the projector works, and that the seats are clean, and that they have candy that's not poisonous, because they want people to keep going back to the theater, because they want to make a profit. So, duh, I would much rather go to a privately owned theater than something run by the government. So, to me, a lot of these people who flip out about, oh, the Fed's privately owned, to me, that thing sounds kind of silly. And the other thing, too, is, yeah, it's privately owned, but it's a very circumscribed notion of ownership. That these commercial banks, for example, that own shares of stock in the Fed, they can't sell them, right? So if you own shares of stock in Google, you're allowed to sell it to somebody for the stock price or whatever the price is when you sell it, right? And so that's not true when it comes to the shares of stock in the Fed. And then, of course, another huge difference between the Fed and a more typical privately owned corporation is that the government appoints the chairman. Right? We just went through the president appointed Janet Yellen, and then the Senate has to confirm it or something. So it's not like with Walmart, the president recommends who the next CEO of Walmart's going to be, and the Senate has to confirm or reject. That's not how it works. No, it's the shareholders do that. And so, that's the Fed. I mean, I refer to it as a quasi-private organization because it's more private than, like I say, the Environmental Protection Agency, which is literally just an agency of the government. But on the other hand, it's more government or more public, if you want to use that term, than just a standard corporation like Walmart or something like that. So there's that element. Now back to your question, Andrew. So given that the Fed is owned by private parties that are banks, and so you can't I don't think there's any way you can easily go verify and say, hey, how much of the Federal Reserve is owned by Rupert Murdoch? I don't think there's any way to make that, because it's the shares of stock that their financial institutions that directly own the Fed, in the sense that they are the legal owners of the shares of stock constituting the Federal Reserve, and they're the ones that get the dividend payments when the Fed issues dividend payments to its owners. So that, by the way, that's another difference too. The EPA doesn't issue dividend checks to its owners. And, you know, the EPA's budget comes from Congress. The Fed doesn't have a budget that Congress authorizes. The Fed doesn't use tax dollars. No, the Fed creates money and buys assets with it that yield it an income. So it's the contrary. The Fed gives its excess earnings back to Congress, because the Fed is a money-making operation, no pun intended. The Fed literally makes money, so no kidding that it makes money in the colloquial sense. Whereas, you know, the EPA arguably destroys wealth and makes people not able to make money, but it itself, to pay its employees and what have you, the EPA needs to get funding from Congress, because there's no way for the EPA to earn a revenue from outside parties, whereas the Fed can buy assets and then buy bonds, and the bondholder or the bond issuers then pay to the Fed. Okay, so that's the sense in which the Fed is privately owned. And so, like I say, a lot of people, that sends off alarm bells, and they smell a rat. And, of course, in the real world, it is true that what the Fed's doing is crazy and doing all kinds of stuff behind the scenes that benefit rich banking interests. So that's certainly true. But all I meant before is that when I'm trying to get people to wake up to that fact, I don't rest my case on the fact that the Fed is privately owned, because in my mind, that's not really the issue. That in my ideal world, any organization that created money would be privately owned. And so that's not what is really wrong about the current relationship. But it is kind of nutty in the sense that one of the functions of the Federal Reserve is to act as an agency providing oversight and discipline in the banking sector. So surely there's a conflict of interest if it's owned by banks. That would be like if the Food and Drug Administration were not an arm of the federal government that was funded by tax dollars to go out and make sure that the drugs and the food that were brought to market were safe. But what if instead a consortium of restaurants and pharmaceutical companies owned the Food and Drug Administration, I mean, literally owned it, owned shares of stock in it, and that a lot of the board of directors and the personnel making decisions in the FDA were literally nominated by the consortium of restaurants and pharmaceutical companies. I mean, everybody would say, whoa, that's insane. That's so nakedly a conflict of interest. And yet that's exactly how the Federal Reserve works. If you go and again, this isn't conspiracy stuff. This is the Fed's own website. Go to the Fed website and just look at the structure of hierarchy and how their boards of directors are appointed and blah, 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 and how you get to be on the Federal Open Market Committee. And a lot of it is, the banks themselves who are being regulated by the Fed and controlled by the Fed are the ones putting up those personnel. So it's kind of a crazy system all around. But then to say, you know, is it owned and run by the Rothschilds? Sure. I bet it is, just because that family is so rich and has its hand in so many different areas, that surely these financial institutions that literally own the Fed are partially controlled by them. But, you know, you can't go look and see, whose name is on the deed, because that's not how it works. It's more of an intermediate large institution that's nominally owned. So then you'd have to say, okay, well, who are the shareholders in these groups? And I'm sure you keep doing the background checks. Eventually you're going to hit Rothschild somewhere in the mix. But what does that prove? I don't know. You know what I mean? It would be stunning if they didn't somehow partially own the Fed, just because if you're a wealthy banking family, of course you're going to end up owning stock in various entities, some of which own stock in the Fed. So I'm not trying to say, oh, it's a crazy rumor that has no, that doesn't mean anything. I'm just saying, yeah, it's hard to, you would have to get inside of a meeting and see, oh, did they get a memo from somebody? It's kind of hard to know that stuff. Okay, Andrew then asks, how compatible is Israel Kirzner's work on competition and entrepreneurship to that of Mises and Rothbard? Well, I think Kirzner would say it's very compatible to Mises' work because Kirzner viewed himself merely as elaborating on what Mises had done. Let me think. There's one big difference for sure between Rothbard and Kirzner. And that has to do with whether there can be such a thing as a pure entrepreneur. And let me just, I'm thinking here to make sure I state this correctly. By the way, if you guys have more questions, go ahead and keep posting them. Okay, so I'm just, forgive me for a minute. I have to get my train of thought and make sure I say this right. So Kirzner treats the entrepreneur as a pure, or I should say entrepreneurship is this pure isolated function that's distinct from being a capitalist. So in the Kirznerian worldview, when we're thinking through the various functions of people in a market economy, you can imagine like the pure worker or laborer, someone who sells labor services in exchange for wages. And the laborer, okay. And then you can imagine the pure landowner, someone who owns land, and remember land is a can be including any nature given factor. So land's not just literally real estate, but it's also if you owned a diamond mine, then you would be a landowner. If you owned a river and trout were in it and you allowed fishermen and women to come in and pay you a fee for the right to fish into your river and get trout, well, then that would be, you would be a landowner. That you'd say, well, how are you getting your revenue? It's from selling your land or renting out your land, all right? Whereas the worker, of course, is selling labor services or renting out his body, if that's the way you want to think of it. And then the capitalist, what does the capitalist do in a market economy? Well, the capitalist earns, or at least this is how Kirzner would describe it, would say the capitalist lends out financial capital and then receives interest. And that ultimately what's happening is the capitalist with his financial capital could consume today, but postpones consumption. And so the what you earn in the market is you're selling present goods and you're buying future goods. And since present goods trade at a premium against future goods, that's how the capitalist grows wealthier over time or enjoys a stream of income over time. And I mean, just think of it this way, that if you're a capitalist right now and you own 100 apples, you could eat them right now, but you say, no, I'm going to sell them in the marketplace and then go use the money to go buy claims on apples available in 1 year. So future apples. It is the way the market prices work because there's a premium on present goods versus future goods. If you sell 100 apples today, you can take that money and then buy claims to 110 apples next year for a 10% interest rate, at least on apples, real rate of interest on apples. And so if that makes sense to you, even though it might be kind of silly to think of just in terms of apples, that's kind of the standard Austrian pure time preference theory explanation for how those who command present goods, if they're willing to postpone consumption, can transform them, can trade them in the marketplace, and end up down the road with a greater amount of real goods. And so that's what the capitalist is. The capitalist is the person that owns financial resources right now and then can deploy them in certain ways. All right. So that's, so those are the various sources of income available to various functions in a market economy. And of course, in the real world, any actual human being is going to be a combination of those, of one or more of those roles or those functional types. You could be a worker and a capitalist. You could be a worker and a landowner. But, you know, it's normal in terms of just pure theory to separate them out and just to think of them in terms of their pure functions to understand how it is that people earn income. So in that framework, what is it that the entrepreneur does? And so Kirzner says, well, the entrepreneur is the person who surveys the scene and looks at all of these available inputs, that sees the workers out there selling labor hours, that sees the landowners selling or renting out natural resources, and sees the capitalists who are willing to lend capital at a certain interest rate. And so it's the entrepreneur who has nothing but a vision of the future and conceives of the possibility to then go out, borrow money from the capitalist at a certain interest rate, then use that money to go hire workers and raw materials and blah, 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 create the product, sell it to consumers down the road, and then if the entrepreneur was correct, was able to then get enough back to pay off the capitalist, the original principal of the loan plus interest, and now if he has anything left over, that's pure profit. So that's the way the entrepreneur earns an income, which we call profit, is realizing all the opportunities for what's available to then borrow money from the pure capitalist, hire all the factors of production, and then be able to pay the capitalist back, not just the original principal, but also the interest. And then if there's anything left, well, that's what pure profit is. Because you've generated a return over and above just the difference in time. Okay, so make sure you realize that. That's what I was trying to stress in the lecture this week, the difference between accounting profit and economic profit, that it's not enough for a business to just take in more total dollars from its customers than the total dollars it paid out in the past to the workers and other sellers of raw materials for the inputs. That you need to, at the very least, also take account of the time delay. That if you spent $1 million on your business in January, and then you tell me at the end of December, okay, we've taken in $1,050,000, well, that right there is not proof that you did a good job, because maybe if the interest rate is 10%, well, gee, that $1 million tied up for a year in this enterprise, I should have earned at least $100,000 in accounting profit in order just to break even, because that $1 million could have earned $100,000 if I just lent it out at interest. Or if it's not your money, then it's really easy to see. If you borrowed $1 million from someone in January and spent it on factors of production, hiring workers, blah, 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 and then by the end of the year, you just had $1,050,000 in your cash registers to show for it. Well, you've clearly lost money if you agreed to pay 10% interest to the capitalist who lent you the money, because you owe them $1,100,000 to be totally free and clear. If you only have $1,050,000, you're short. So there you can clearly see you suffered a loss. But even if, like I say, even if it was your capital to start out with, you implicitly suffered a loss because of the opportunity cost. Okay, so that's the way Kirzner views it. So in his world mind, the entrepreneur, the pure entrepreneur, brings nothing to the table except his vision. And then he draws on all the other factors of production and functional roles to make the thing happen. So the entrepreneur is still the driving force of the market, because each of those other people are just offering their product or their service to the highest bidder. And they don't directly steer what gets produced. It's the entrepreneur who decides these particular units of these factors are going to be combined to make this product. And so it's the entrepreneur that's the true decision maker. Okay, so Rothbard says, wait a minute, Kirzner, that's not right. That in the real world, there's no such thing as the pure entrepreneur. Because the capitalists, you know, that little standard setup there, where Kirzner's imagining the pure entrepreneur going up to the capitalist and saying, hey, I need $1 million to hire these workers and to buy these resources, blah, 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 because I think I'm going to be able to sell them next year and I'll pay you 10% interest. In that story, the workers and the resource owners, you can say that they're not being entrepreneurial because they're getting paid on the spot. They're getting, you know, they're getting their share of that $1 million upfront capital that was invested into the business. But clearly the capitalist who has to agree to this project is also entrepreneurial because there's no guarantee that the capitalist is going to get his money back. Because what if, you know, he says, okay, yeah, sure, here's $1 million. You're going to pay me back $1.1 million next year. And the person invests in it, hires the workers, but $1 million is gone. Now he's just got whatever this intermediate capital good is that, in terms of the process that this entrepreneur's vision requires. And then he goes to bring it to market a year later and nobody buys it. It's a complete dud and the thing is just useless. And no one would even offer a penny for it. I mean, that's possible. And so now what? And so he goes back to the capitalist and says, sorry, it was a complete dud. I don't have a penny to give you. And unless the entrepreneur, you know, put up his own house or something as collateral, the capitalist totally eats the loss. And now the capitalist is out, in his mind, $1.1 million, because that's what he should have had at this point. Now he has nothing instead. So he's out $1.1 million. So in that story, you know, who's the real entrepreneur? Rothbard wants to say the capitalist is also an entrepreneur. It's like a joint venture, even if legally that's not the way it works. The capitalist has to realize, to put it another way, it can't be the case that if you are a capitalist and control financial resources, that you just go ahead and lend your capital to the highest bidder. If someone comes along and says, no, I got a project, I'll pay you 15% interest. As the capitalist, you're not just going to say, oh, okay, 15% is better than 10. No, you have to evaluate what the project is and see, am I actually going to get paid that? And if someone comes along with some idea that to you seems nutty, then you might say, no, I'm not going to lend you this money. Even if you sign a contract guaranteeing me 22% interest, because I can't see how you're going to earn that. Okay, so, and the only way you would do that as a capitalist is if the borrower put up really good collateral and said, well, look, I got this house that's worth $3 million and it's all paid off. So worst case scenario, if I can't pay you, I'll put my house up for sale and then I'll be able to pay you out of those proceeds. All right, so, but once you go down that path, then you see that entrepreneur is not a pure entrepreneur. He is bringing something to the table. So in Rothbard's view, instead of just talking about capitalists and just talking about entrepreneurs as these distinct functions in a market economy, you want to talk about the capitalist entrepreneur with a little hyphen in between them. So that's a distinction. And so now the question is, well, who's right in terms of who's Misesian? Because Rothbard and Kirzner thought they were elaborating the worldview of Mises when it comes to capitalists and entrepreneurs. And Rothbard was particularly gracious. You know, a lot of times when Rothbard's arguing with somebody, he's a prize fighter. He's throwing uppercuts and really trying to win and get the reader to see that Rothbard is right and this other guy's wrong. Okay. But on this particular one, Rothbard says something, you know, he's going back and forth in a series of written exchanges with Kirzner, and Rothbard says, I don't remember the exact word, but says something like, you know, this is one case that's fairly rare where Mises was, he didn't say unclear, but he just said something like, I can see why Professor Kirzner thinks that he's just fleshing out what is in Mises, because yeah, there are passages in Human Action and elsewhere where Mises does sound like he's conceiving of the entrepreneur as this pure disembodied function that just makes decisions without any regard to being constrained by the capitalist or something like that. And it's a pure function, and then the capitalists are their own separate thing. So Rothbard acknowledges that, yeah, I can see why Kirzner thinks that's what Mises meant. But then Rothbard just comes back and says, but look at these other passages where Mises says such and such. So that's where I'm coming from. And that's why I still think Kirzner's wrong. So anyway, that was perhaps a longer and more detailed answer than you could want it there, Andrew. But that's, I think that's the issue. So they, each of their work is very compatible with Mises' work on this topic. And there is a sharp distinction between Rothbard and Kirzner when it comes to entrepreneurship. But that's because there is that tension in Mises that in some passages it looks like he's saying one thing and the other is the other. And so they both kind of just elaborated on those different elements in Mises' worldview. Okay, Kim says, do you think Chris Christie is done as a presidential candidate? Any thoughts on other potential candidates? Will Rand Paul run? You know, I don't watch politics enough to know. I mean, I do watch politics, Kim, but I'm not enough of a junkie to be able to look back and say, well, you know, did anybody ever come back from a scandal as bad as Christie's was and then end up being the nominee? See what I mean? So I don't know. I just don't know how long this kind of thing. So if the nomination were to be held next month, then yeah, I would say there's no chance Christie can win. The people would just, the insiders would say, no, he's unelectable. We can't put him up. It's got to be somebody else because this scandal's too big. But will it still be too big by the election? I don't know. And as far as Rand Paul, it certainly looks like he's trying to groom himself to run, put it that way. And so my guess would be if he thought he had a decent shot at the nomination, then he would run. But if his internal polling and blah, blah, blah says he doesn't think he'll get it, then maybe he wouldn't. But even there, I mean, I really am not good at this kind of stuff. And so I don't know. Like, I think there's something to be said for a certain type of candidate might enter into the nomination process, even knowing full well that he's not going to get it this time, but just to get his name out there and to plant the seed in people's minds that he's a legitimate, viable candidate. Like if he thought he could do it and he would come in first in a few states or caucuses and then, you know, second or third in some other ones and just make a decent showing, but ultimately he doesn't get it, then that might be worth doing just to, you know, in case the Democrat wins, then maybe, what is it, 2020, then he comes back and now he's a great viable candidate to get the nomination and then go against and unseat the really unpopular Democratic person who at that point would have been wrapping up his or her first term. So that there's that kind of consideration too. If they think it's going to be Hillary Clinton, then, you know, maybe Rand's people would say, what we want ultimately is we're sure, you know, we don't know if you're going to beat the brand new Democratic candidate who's never been in the White House, but we bet you the public will be so sick of Hillary Clinton after 4 years that you'd be perfect to run against her when she's trying to get reelected or something like that. I don't know. So if that's the kind of case, then maybe they do start out. Or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe they say, no, we're only going to get one bite of this apple. Let's wait until we really think you're going to win. And then we'll just go in, put all the chips in. And maybe if you don't go in this next time around, it'll be good with the public and it'll look like you went into politics because you really wanted to help your state and not just because you had ambitions to become president. So I'm not really answering your question, Tim, just because I there's so many different ways these things can go. And it's just politics is so anathema to me. Like I couldn't even get, I ran for student council when I was, what, in either seventh or eighth grade, I forget. And then I got, then I lost, and that's when I decided politics is awful. People don't elect the right person, they elect the popular person, and the reason the person's popular is because people are stupid. So there you go. Now the truth comes out. Bob's been bitter since junior high. Okay, Steven Schechter says, do you see a realistic path for the U.S. to go back to a gold standard, or any country, maybe one exiting the EU in the future? Would it take a monetary collapse to consider it? How would it affect what countries trade with fiat countries? Okay, that's a great question. I think I don't think the U.S. would go back to a gold standard. I think what would what conceivably could happen is if there is a crisis where I'm not saying that this is what's going to happen, but I could see something along these lines happening where a year or two go by and then things start to seem to get back to a little bit normal. Like people are, unemployment's still really bad and the average person is still struggling to make ends meet, but it seems like we're out of the woods. And so that businesses start expanding again, perhaps tepidly, but they start to, okay. Because right now, I think everyone's kind of like in lockdown mode and just waiting for the world to collapse. And then they're kind of like, well, maybe it won't collapse. And so now they're kind of relaxing a little bit. And so if that starts happening and commercial banks start lending out, that's a bit of a metaphor or a misnomer. If they start making loans again, because right now there's like $2 trillion in what's called excess reserves in the U.S. commercial banking system. So commercial banks are legally allowed, given reserve ratio requirements, to make a lot more loans to regular people and businesses than they are right now. So if things start getting back to normal, commercial banks start thinking that, okay, yeah, I'll start making loans to small businesses and other people. Moderate interest rates, because that now we kind of think they'll be able to pay it back with the economy getting back to some sort of normal condition. Then there's just rough figures here. There's like the ability to create something like $20 trillion more dollars in the sense of checking account balances. And so if that were to happen, you could imagine prices starting to rise pretty rapidly. And so then the issue is, well, how would the authorities deal with that? And if they dealt with it by just printing more money to try to stay ahead of the curve, you get into a situation where the dollar could start rapidly losing its value, could even crash against other currencies, certainly against commodities. So in that kind of a framework, and then the similar things happening in Europe, you could imagine some like the IMF issuing some type of world currency that is backed by a basket of commodities. So I don't think they would necessarily directly say it was gold, because that might have a lot of baggage, and so many academics have been so loudly denouncing the gold standard and how awful it was. And also it would tie their hands more. If they just pledged a fixed price of gold in terms of whatever that new currency was. So I would think it's more plausible that they would issue some kind of money that was backed by what they call the basket of commodities, one of which might very well be gold. And so then they would say, what we're going to do is we will manage the supply of this new currency that's issued by the IMF or the World Bank or whatever, and that will we will keep the weighted price of this basket of commodities in a certain band. And that, if the price in terms of these basket, in terms of this commodity gets above, then we will restrict the quantity of this thing and to bring the price back down. And if it goes below, then we'll issue more. And then if they did that, then I could see, first of all, I can see the popularity of that thing, and then you can imagine Americans turning in their dollars for that thing to say, hey, now that the dollar's too volatile, let me switch over to this kind of currency. So I could see if what the people behind the scenes wanted was a regional currency, so that Americans were not just using dollars, but they were using something that other people in other countries use. One easy way, or not easy, but one way to make it more possible to get Americans to do that would be if the dollar itself was very volatile and weak and seemed like it was no longer a stable currency, but this new thing had some kind of hard asset backing that made it look more attractive. So I could see them doing that. And then the beauty of that, too, is they could just suspend redemption in terms of those commodities if they want it. You know what I'm saying? Like, if initially they were saying, no, if you turn this thing in, we will give you these physical commodities if you want. And that's how you can be guaranteed that this thing really is backed up by this oil and tungsten and gold or whatever it is. But then, you know, once they got the world using that stuff, they waited a few years and got everyone to switch over. Then if they wanted to, they could just say, oh, you know what? We're not going to honor that pledge anymore. Which is what happened with the gold, obviously. So they could do that. Any other questions? We got about 7 minutes left. While you guys are thinking, let me just talk a little bit more about that last point. I don't know exactly why they don't back their currencies with some sort of hard asset. So, for example, China, my understanding is there was the so-called Asian flu back in the late 90s, where there were like a lot of currencies. They didn't collapse, but like major drops in various Asian currencies. And I think China decided they were going to reassure the world that their currency was solid, and that they could go ahead and invest in China and blah, 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 and be reassured that they weren't going to just have their assets expropriated and not be able to convert them into a different currency. And that's when they really started stockpiling U.S. treasuries, and they pegged their currency to the dollar to try to effectively tell the world, look, our currency is as stable as the U.S. dollar, and you all trust the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. And the way to make that credible, you need to have a bunch of treasuries, right? Because what is it the treasuries are? In case you don't, sorry if I'm using terminology, a treasury is the shorthand term for a bond issued by the U.S. Treasury. So when the federal government runs a budget deficit, and they want to spend more than they take in tax revenue, they got to borrow the money. And so the way they do that is they issue bonds, which are IOUs, from the treasury. So they're called treasuries, all right? So China, if it wants to convince investors to lend it money or to invest in China and to trust that goods priced in the Chinese currency are not going to fluctuate wildly in value, then they say, hey, we will tie our currency to the dollar, according to this ratio, so that you can be assured that one U.S. dollar will trade for such and such, whatever it is, 7.5 yuan or whatever. And then the way they can back that up is that they have a huge stockpile of dollars. So they don't literally keep $100 bills in a vault somewhere. Rather, they buy treasuries that yield interest. But the treasuries, if you think about what are they? They're dollar-denominated assets. That if you own, if you buy $1 billion in treasury bonds that yield 5%, that means when they mature next year, the U.S. government is going to send you a check for $1 billion. What is it? $50,000 or $50 million? Right, so now you're getting those dollars. So you are owed actual flows of U.S. dollars. And so that's how you can credibly promise to world investors, we can support our currency in the foreign exchange market. Because what would happen is, what if their currency starts falling? What if now, instead of it being 7.5, a U.S. dollar can buy 8, can buy 9, can buy 10 of the Chinese currency? Well, the way they can try to push it back is they can enter the currency markets if they have dollars and start buying their own currency back and sucking it off the market to push the price back down or the exchange rate back down. Right? But if they don't have dollars, they can't do that. So that's partly what happened. So anyway, now I think the Chinese government is realizing, oh, maybe tying our currency to the U.S. dollar was not the smartest move available to us. Because look at what the Federal Reserve has been doing. And so I would think really what they want to do to ultimately be completely independent and to show the world what an economic powerhouse they are, is they would ultimately start accumulating vast quantities of gold and silver and other commodities. Maybe not literally the physical thing, but maybe like shares of mining companies or something like that. And then tell the world, look at our currency is backed up by these hard assets, which is even stronger than the U.S. dollar. So, but they haven't done that. And this is pure speculation. I think part of it is they're happy in the position they're in, and they're just saying, you know what, why don't we just wait? The U.S. will hang itself. And another thing is possibly they just want to get their ducks in a row first, because since the Chinese own such huge stockpiles of U.S. treasuries, if they make a move that would make investors around the world dump the U.S. dollar and then rush to the Chinese-denominated assets, well, that would crash the treasury market. That would make U.S. interest rates go up, which means the market price of U.S. bonds drops, and so the Chinese would be effectively destroying a huge amount of the wealth that they currently own. So I think there's all kinds of issues like that. And then last but not least, the U.S. is still pretty strong militarily, and a lot of these governments don't want to anger the U.S. authorities. There are always conspiracy theories running around about, hey, why did the U.S. finally take out Gaddafi? Why did they invade Iraq? Because there's all kinds of different regimes around the globe doing things that are the same bad stuff that the other countries that the U.S. invades are doing. You know what I mean? Like, if you're concerned about human rights abuses, it's not like the only governments doing that are the ones the U.S. happened to invade over the past few years. That's not true. And so some people say, oh, the real explanation for which countries the U.S. government decided to really take out, or which regimes, are the people that tried to challenge the dollar hegemony. So I haven't done enough research to say whether that's a plausible theory or not, but I am just so you guys are aware of that, that there are people saying that that's kind of how you can understand the international financial aspects of this, that what looks like it would be an obvious move to do in a certain country's interest to get investors to flock to it, maybe they don't do it because they don't want to have the U.S. government go ballistic on them, no pun intended. Okay, well, this was kind of an hour devoted to conspiracy theories. That was not my intention, but there you go. And my favorite line with all that stuff is a lot of people will say, when they're bringing up these kind of things, and someone will say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory, and the person says, I don't deal in conspiracy theories, I deal in conspiracy facts. Boom! Okay. So, I will see you guys next week, and we're starting to get into the really good stuff in the textbook that gives you any motivation to get your nose back in lessons for the young times. Also remember to check your syllabus, because there are readings from David Gordon's book that I don't know if it's this week or next week, but start picking in as well. So just make sure you're keeping up with that as well. Okay, see you guys next week.